I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. George Orr has a new film out, one that is having its world premiere Saturday afternoon, the 3rd of June. If you're like me, a consumer of news, a citizen, a bit of an amateur historian, a political junkie, and an admirer of broadcasting, this is the film to see. It's called Talk, and it's a look at the 50 years or so Vancouver had some top-notch journalism and first-rate talk radio. In the film, he chronicles how Vancouverites got their news from the 1950s on through the radio and how radio stations here, in particular CKNW, so dominated the market. The talk show phenomenon took off when Peter Kosick came up with the format and put Jack Webster on the air. He soon followed with Pat Burns, and both typified the sort of open-line radio where, for the first time, the average citizen could call up and vent or ask questions of the newsmakers of the day. The film features footage from the archives as well as clips, interviews, and insight into what made this place such a competitive news market not only in Canada but throughout the continent. Some of the people interviewed in the film include Jim Pattison, who owned NW's rival station CJOR, Bill Hughes, the enterprising and cunning general manager of CKNW, Warren Barker, NW's legendary news director, George Garrett, the intrepid reporter, who remains highly respected in this town today, as well as genius morning host Frosty, Brian Forrest. Also featured in the film, Gary Bannerman, Rafe Mayer, Bill Good, as well as premiers of British Columbia, Bill Vandersem, Eugène Desange, Gordon Campbell, and Christy Clark, talk show host at one point, who shares her thoughts on the decline of talk radio in this market. The film screens at 12:30 on Saturday the 3rd. It'll be at the Pacific Cinematheque, 1131 Howe Street. You can get tickets on the Eventbrite website. I'll get George, who joins me now, to talk about this labor of love, the history he salvaged, and what one might expect the afternoon of the 3rd. George Orr is a filmmaker, journalist, educator, and for a spell last year, an attempted politician. He was last on in September when his candidacy for the BC Green Party was rejected. Perhaps we'll talk about the result of this past month's election as well. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, George Orr. Mr. Orr, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm old and grumpy.
Grumpy about trying to put this film on the big screen, or about the election result?
No, grumpy about getting old.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, I turned 35 recently. I can understand the feeling.
I turned 70 the day before this thing screened, so I'm twice as grumpy as you.
Yeah, there you go.
Or maybe it's exponential. I don't know.
How did you end up here in the West Coast? When was that?
I moved to BC from Ontario. Pardon me, in 1975, I came out looking for nice weather and drove across the country in the middle of winter, arrived here, it was spring, and I thought, well, I'm staying.
Yeah.
And, I recall driving through the Fraser Valley when I moved out here, listening to a radio station covering a prison riot. I had no idea who this was, what it was about, but it was really exciting because it was sort of live news.
Mm-hmm.
And flash forward a couple of years, and I'm working for that radio station, and it was... CKNW ran the business of journalism in this market. I had a job for 2 years for Warren Barker. I was a night reporter, and my job was not to go home until he had a story in the 8 o'clock newscast that nobody else had. So he would want to set the agenda for the next day with a story. So if I got up by 10, I could go home. If I had to work until 3 in the morning phoning people saying, oh, did I wake you up?
Mm-hmm.
That was okay.
Yeah.
My job was to give him something of a scoop every day. Because that's how CKNW worked.
Yeah, and that, you get a sense watching your film just what that station meant to this town. I mean, there were other stations, as there are now, but there was not a station that so dominated the market and set the agenda, as you said, at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
Whatever was on that major news to 8 was what everyone was talking about, what the other outlets were chasing down the rest of the day.
And it was really, in the news end of it was really Warren, because he would go to work at midnight, 5, maybe 6 days a week, and he would stay until noon. And he would, overnight, he would phone every police and fire detachment in the region and say, what's new? He'd find out what's new. Sometimes it was news, most of the time it wasn't. So he had an encyclopedic knowledge of the region, its history, sort of little news story by little news story over decades. And so he, I had no idea how he carried it all. I mean, he had files, but he...
Mm-hmm.
You could rely on him for anything about anything, from a plumber's union vote 15 years ago where so-and-so got elected, and he probably knew the numbers of the votes.
Mm.
And he was the world's best boss because he never complained and he never embarrassed you, and he gave you a lot of license as long as you were first.
And so you get a sense in the film of his work and what he meant to this community, what he meant to journalists like you over the years. How was he able to do it? Because, I mean, radio stations, I mean, it seems foreign now in this market to think of a news director having that sort of latitude. What was his situation in terms of the management of the station in his years and whoever owned it? I mean, they gave him free rein, didn't they?
Absolutely.
And in the broadcast day, news was the big focus.
And this is well prior to the internet, so the sources of information are either your car radio, the news at 6, or the newspaper. And before the news at 6 became video, mm-hmm. television was really a distant partner in this. But radio was instant. And this was in the 50s and 60s when people were coming home from the war and starting families and building houses and buying appliances that advertised on the radio, and cars and furniture and. So radio was there to sell you everything your heart desires. And they made a sack of money because a lot of people would listen in their car, in the kitchen, over the dinner table, listen to the ads, listen to the talk shows, feel engaged. It was a cult.
Yeah.
A cult of information. A cult's not quite the right word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You had to listen, because if you didn't listen, it's sort of like watching Donald Trump now. Like, if you miss an hour, well, what did I miss?
Yeah.
But it was like that in this region for about 50 years.
And it was such a part of the community. I mean, they had ladies bowling and the Orphans Fund, which remains today.
Yeah.
Herring sales.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I can't think of anyone that eats herring, let alone, you know, would buy it. It would go line up and with their buckets and buy this stuff.
Yep.
But it was such a big deal, and it was such a part of that in New Westminster there on the pier.
And the Fishermen's Union would donate a boat and a bunch of fishermen, and the NW staff would go down and shovel smelly fish. And
So you were, how long were you at the station?
I was there from 79 till somewhere in the early 80s, at which point I decided TV looked much more exciting, which, in retrospect, I think was a mistake. The thing about being a radio reporter is you go to an event, you have to decide what the journalism here is. You know, maybe, you know, speeches or a convention or something. You have to find what's going to be considered to be the story, the narrative. You have to make that decision. You have to put it in less than 100 words, and you have to push it through a telephone as fast as you can. And you have to do it before anybody else does.
Yeah.
And so the freedom and the latitude and the creativity was boundless. And you were constrained by the fact you had to tell the truth. It had to be demonstrably true, because most events had a variety of reporters. And if you said X and everybody else said Y, you'd be out of a job soon.
Yeah.
So you were constrained by how fast you could read, how fast you could write, how fast you could drive to get there. And so it was sensational. And I never heard a negative word about anything in that regard. It was always, it was expected you do well.
Yeah.
And it was a grand working environment.
And because at that point, in the years that we're talking about, NW was owned also, the people who own NW also own BCTV. And so that's why BCTV became such a powerhouse in this market. It's because a lot of those skills that were the emphasis on news moved over to BCTV.
Barker had this idea of the hard hustle of news. Find the story, break it, move on. And it wore people out. I mean, I was there for a couple of years, and I would end up working 14, 15-hour days because the boss goes in at midnight. You know, so you can't complain if you have to get up at 5 in the morning to do stuff.
Yeah.
He kept – he had this stable of people. Cameron Bell was a staffer at CKNW News. Cameron Bell ended up being the bright light behind BCTV when they were huge.
Yeah.
A lot of people who started for Warren ended up working other places, because if you had NW on your resume, you could walk in anywhere.
Yeah.
That's how I got a job at the CBC. That's how a lot of people got jobs in other broadcasters, because you'd cut your teeth in NW. So BCTV applied the principles of Barker with pictures and ended up with audiences of, you know, 700,000-800,000 people at a time.
And the component that made NW such a fixture in everyone's house and in the car radios was not only the news, but on the other side were the talk shows. Now, Peter Kosick, did he ever work at CKNW?
He did. He started when LG started. LG stands for Lionsgate. CKLG is the Lionsgate Radio. Started in North Van. Was at Lonsdale and 13th. He'd worked there, moved to NW in sales, went back to LG for a bit and then went to CJOR. And Peter's, he's in his 90s, I think, now.
Yeah.
Fascinating man, sharp as a tack, interesting character, tolerates no fools. So I don't think he was a charm to work for. But he had this idea of, well, we have this new technology, the telephone and the microphone, and we can hold people in account to power. It, socially, it's a good thing because Peter's a very socially driven person. And in terms of numbers, it's sensational because for the first time ever, you sitting at home listening to the old radio can reach out and punch that son of a gun in the nose in Victoria.
Yeah.
So you finally, as a citizen, you have power. So Peter found the magic bullet, put lightning in the bottle.
And so he decides to get callers to call in, and the talk radio was born in this town. And was Webster the first?
Webster was it. I mean, Webster had been on NW for some time prior to this and would take calls on occasion, but it wasn't part of the process. Mm-hmm. Webster would sort of...
He was an interviewer, and
And he'd been a reporter. You know, he'd grown up as a young guy. He'd been a reporter in Scotland, and fairly hard scrabble. So he wasn't subtle, and he liked the notion of speaking truth to power. But he liked speaking truth.
Yeah.
Well, Cossack had this idea that with Webster as the, sort of the maitre d' of speaking truth to power, you could, it would work.
Yeah.
So, and it was a Sunday night, and they tried it, and Peter's telling of it is in the movie, and it's and. It worked because they're still at it.
People called in, and you know, Jack Webster got to report and talk to these people, and it became such a phenomenon. And so, at what point does Burns get into the story? Pat Burns.
Pat Burns came to Vancouver. He'd been in England during the war, and he'd gotten a job with the BBC, and he was quite sort of, you know, a BBC kind of broadcaster. Yeah. Ended up in Vancouver, ended up working in print for a while as a sports reporter, and then Cossack found him and hired him and thought, well, inside this man is a firebrand of the first order, if I can just pull the cork out and let him go. And so Cossack claims to have put lightning in another bottle with Burns. So we had Burns on CJOR and Webster on CKNW because they tended to go where the money was, and NW would do whatever they had to do to make sure that they had the best talent possible. So these two guys at various times were on air together, on air separately, in competition with each other, and they owned the town.
Yeah.
They owned the town.
And Burns was a marvelous broadcaster. And, I mean, it was a phenomenon in the sound. Everyone listened to him.
He was, I mean, there are now broadcasters in sort of the alt-right radio stations in the States who are, they're firebrands.
Yeah.
And they're just, you can't stop listening. You don't have to agree with them. Most people probably don't. But they're so outrageous, and they're so provocative, and they're so articulate. And Burns was a well-read, very articulate, thoughtful man with a really hot point of view about everything. Generally anti-whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever the government was, he was absolutely against it. Tended towards the right wing of politics, but mostly just against power and against the abuse of power. And so he would, he was just a miserable son of a bitch.
Did you know him well?
I never met him.
No.
I never met him. I dealt with him on the phone a couple of times when I was in TV. He'd gotten to the point in the 80s where he'd sort of had crested and was sort of coasting a bit and could be interviewed for television. So we'd had conversations, but I never met him, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I found tape.
Yeah.
Found a piece of tape that was long lost of Pat Burns being interviewed about his life and times.
Yeah, and then you have a lot of great film, a lot of good audio as well in this film. A lot of that stuff that is stuff that you've collected over the years, is that right?
I was the early morning assignment guy at BCTV in the early 80s, and I'd be in at 6 o'clock and lining up the day, because at that point we had 12 reporters or something. It was an enormous news factory.
Yeah.
And I had to line up reporters and cameras and paper. And Webster had his talk show. And he would come sit on the corner of my desk and smoke my cigarettes and talk about the good old days while I'm trying to work. And on the one hand, it was a massive annoyance because the guy I worked for was rather humorless and wanted stuff done. But on the other hand, these grand Scottish brogue and these great stories about the good old days. And I kept thinking, this is sensational stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, you know.
And you're a kid, right? So, I mean.
Yeah. You know. And, you know, I'm only a couple of years in the business, and I'm still thinking, well, this is, you know, we're on a crusade for justice and truth and all that stuff, and we're doing God's work, and, here's this guy who's been at this. Like, here's the guy that started it all from my perspective.
Yeah.
And so I just started looking for ways to find. I had no idea then that I was going to do anything other than just.
Be a reporter, right?
And sort of be interested in, like, I'm a historian, I guess, yeah. Kind of like yourself. I'm interested in how things came to be. So I started talking with people and knowing librarians and collecting a bit of this and a bit of that. At one point, I was teaching at BCIT. They used to give us old tapes. They'd take a box of tapes that had been used once, and they'd either throw them out or give them to the students so the students could learn how to edit.
Yeah.
So I get this box of tapes, and in them are two 3/4-inch cassettes. They're in a good size. Like almost a telephone book size each. And on them, Jack Webster is being given an honorary degree at Simon Fraser University. It's a 2-camera shoot, out of which, at the time, they probably used 45 seconds. Well, I've got this stuff, and it's broadcast quality, and it's in the garbage, essentially, and I'd look at it, and I thought, this is it.
Yeah.
So I thought, this is a great story about the good old days. So I started collecting stuff about the good old days in the mid-'80s. So I've been essentially functionally at this since... I guess 87, 86, collecting.
Yeah. So 30 years later. Well, actually yeah. Earlier than 30 years, because yeah. You've been working at this for a long time. You decide to put all this together in a film. You get you interview people like George Garrett and Bill Hughes, yeah. The people that you work with and for, and you piece together the history of not only news in this town, but almost the social history of this province.
Yeah. Well, I when I started working at NW, I was a George, still am. There was a George Garrett and a George Madden, and there was a fellow named George Wilson who worked for the CBC. So one day, I'm the junior of the Georges.
Yeah.
The four Georges are having lunch, and I was told by Warren when I was hired, George Garrett has lots and lots of contacts, and you're not to wreck any of his contacts. If you discover something you think is fascinating, you pass it through George, because he needs to be the arbiter of what we do with really breaking-edge stuff that could, you know, cause a big kerfuffle.
Yeah.
And so I'd always deferred to George Garrett, because at that point he'd been, you know, a senior reporter in town for, you know, decades.
20 years, yeah.
And so comes George's retirement somewhere in the, I guess, the late 90s, and I thought, this is just too good to let go. So I hired a cameraman. I did all the rest of the production myself, but I hired a fellow named Dennis Joyal, lovely guy. Dennis followed George for a month. Not all day, every day, but functionally Dennis tailed George and got George's last month on the job on tape.
Yeah.
And so I had a whole bunch of tape.
Yeah.
It cost me a sack of money, and I had nothing to do. So I had all this old Webster stuff. I'd collected film footage, and I had Garrett's last month. Flash forward about a year, CKNW fired Warren Barker after 49 years because it was Chorus, the mm-hmm. company that owned it, was downsizing, and he was kind of on the payroll, but he'd retired functionally. He was sort of around. And
he would do that morning comment after the news, and he would do an editorial that he would do, and it was on after sports or before Rafe, you know.
Yeah. But they finally decided, you're done. So they pitched him out. And there would be a dinner at the Justice Institute. And if you had worked for Warren, you were invited to the dinner. So I took a camera and shot the dinner. And it was really, it was the last meeting of all of those folks who worked for Warren over from the 50s through the 90s. And they came to pay their respects.
Yeah.
And he made a speech. It was brutally witty and honest and insightful. And I use a little bit of it in the film.
Yeah.
And so I had the Webster stuff and the Garrett stuff and the Barker stuff, and I had some old footage, and still didn't have a story, because a story requires, you know, a plot and a climax and interesting characters, and, you know, not just a series of look back in the mirror. But so I just kept shooting.
Yeah.
Because I'd worked at NW, I had access. You know, whenever they would have something in the talk show studios that I thought was worthy of shooting, I just go and smile at the receptionist and weasel my way in, and everybody kind of knew who I was. Because at that point, I was teaching at BCIT.
Yeah.
So my students were now the talk show producers and some of the talent and some of the journalists. So I kind of shamelessly just sort of showed up, and nobody thought to throw me out. So there would be leadership debates. When Gordon Campbell became premier, he won through a leadership debate he had with Ujjal Dosanjh on the radio.
Rafe Mayer, right?
Yep.
The three of them in the room, and you were there filming this, right?
Yep. And, I mean, the news media are all over there shooting, and mm-hmm. I'm shooting entirely separately, and I know how to shoot, so I know how to... I, understand the dynamics of putting stuff on camera so it works well, but I'm not shooting the news of the day. I'm shooting for, well, at that point I had no idea, but I'm shooting for another purpose, a larger purpose. And did that on and off until my last production was Christy Clark, Leadership Debate with Adrienne Dix, 2013. She goes in the studio and she mops the floor with him.
Yeah.
There was also a TV debate in that election, but functionally, you watch Christy Clark put a nail through the head of talk radio. She was so effective at dismantling. She understood the business because she'd done it, and she was exquisitely good at a populist radio host job, so she knew how to attack and how to deflect. She understood. It was like she'd studied the art of war, and she was at war with somebody who'd never picked up a sword before. And so at that point, I realized this medium has peaked its past because of the internet, because, you know, 2014, because a variety of reasons. So I thought, well, now I have a story.
Do you think, George, that had she not, because she'd been in politics for several years, leaves politics in the middle of the Campbell years, goes to NW to do a talk show, and then when Campbell resigns, comes back again. Had she not had that profile, had she had not that position of being a talk show host, or was it, say, planned that she would do that and then make a return to politics? I mean, because at one point, I tend to think that had she not done the talk show, she would not have succeeded as she has become premier, as she is today.
Well, what you learn in managing a talk show is how to really, I don't like the phrase, but how to push people's buttons.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the newsmaker's buttons. How to connect to the audience. And you connect to the audience by providing them an emotional space to participate in the program. So she told me once that, you know, if you're on air and you've got nothing else to talk about dog poop. She said that you push a button like that, the phones light up, everybody's got an opinion about dogs and sidewalks and poop, and everybody gets really steamed up about it. And functionally, it means nothing in our society, but emotionally, it's huge. And once you learn to master those emotional triggers and then take those skills back into politics, you can do what she did, what Trump does.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they're the same beast, but they employ the same technique in terms of emotionally provoking the listeners. And it doesn't matter if you provoke them to love you or to hate you. That's immaterial. That's what Burns discovered. The people that hated him were just as loyal as the people that loved him.
They listened even though they hated him,
they'd
right?
They'd tune in and swear at the radio and you know, sit around the kitchen table and say, that son of a...
Yeah.
But they listened.
Yeah.
And that was the trick. And she learned that. If you succeed in talk, that's what you learn to do, is emotionally grab your audience and then never let go.
Yeah. And Paul, we talk about the news and the talk shows, but I mean, hand in hand with all of that is the politics of the day.
Yeah.
Premiers of the province, politicians who did well in politics, go into broadcasting, and you see with Christy Clark, go back again. You think of Ralph Mayer, who was a cabinet minister at one point, leaves that to become, I guess, one of the big talk show hosts in the 80s, 90s, and into the 21st century.
Ralph's story is that he was in politics, was interested in... Rafe's kind of a dilettante. I mean, it's not the right word, but he's, you know, enter a field of endeavor, get as much out of it as you can, move on. Like, he was a lawyer and a good lawyer.
Yeah.
Okay, that was fun. Now, politics. And he was in politics, and that was interesting. That was hugely challenging. Okay, now what else is there to do? You know, what ladder can I go up further to be more interesting, to be more engaged, make more money, to be more me? Because there's an aspect of ego in all this that is undeniable. And the harder they deny it, the bigger it is.
Yeah.
So people like Rafe flourished in the business. Rafe was one of the few people, and then Christy. Until Rafe, everybody in the talk show business had been a journalist. They'd met a deadline. They'd covered house fires. They'd, you know, done all that stuff. They'd, you know, read reports. They'd sort of done the footwork of journalism enough to know what's the news in the event. If you're interviewing somebody, what's the nugget you're really after, and what are you going to do with that? How do you move that ahead? How do you sort the wheat from the chaff in real time? Rafe had never done that, and so he always felt like he didn't quite belong. And in the film, he's very articulate about that notion of not quite feeling like he belonged because he hadn't been a reporter.
Always looking over his shoulder.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the other thing about talk radio is you're good today, but somebody else is going to be good tomorrow. So at some point, you're gone.
Yeah.
And then that's, and then at some point, pretty well functionally, what Christy Clark learned out of her time in radio and then her time as premier is she doesn't go back.
Yeah.
She doesn't participate. Bill Van Der Zandt used to do gardening shows with Gary Bannerman.
Yeah.
Bill Bennett every May 24th, Monday, long weekend Monday. Bennett would go on for 3 hours and talk with Bannerman. Long, exhaustive conversations about the political process. Ask anything, answer anything. For politicians then, talk was connecting to the community because you could be guaranteed as the premier that the community listened.
Yeah.
And what politicians have learned in this new age is shut up, have a message of the day, stick to the message, don't make yourself available in situations where you're going to be vulnerable, just shut up. And so that's what they do.
And two other politicians, you mentioned Van Der Zandt, Dave Barrett did talk for a while in between his provincial political career and his federal career.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Campbell, after she was prime minister, went to NW for a spell, and you have her in the film as well.
Yeah, she was. I don't think she enjoyed the talk business very much. She enjoyed not being prime minister because she had such a raw deal from her party. She enjoyed talk, gave her an opportunity to step into public life a little bit, but not to be vulnerable to the kicks and the shins that she was subject to.
Yeah, and so you realize to have a radio station in this market attract talent like that. Former premier, former prime minister.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, you mentioned today how different politicians are in terms of how expressive they are in public and how guarded they've become. I guess that's the reason why this whole phenomenon has peaked, hasn't it?
It has. There are now more people working in communications in BC than there are journalists and have been for quite a while. And so for every politician that opens their mouth, there's one or two people beside them, behind them, in their ear saying, here's what you can say. Here's what's in the box that's okay to say. Do not venture outside of the box.
Don't you take some responsibility in that? Because you were at BCIT for years. I mean, you taught some of these people, right?
Yeah. I actually taught at the police academy for 15 years.
Mm.
And I finally quit because I was hired to help them to teach, to talk, to speak the truth. You know, when I got hired, cops used to put their hand in front of the camera and say, no comment, get lost. Well, I convinced them over time with some work with some other people that it's far more effective to say, to confirm the obvious. You know, when you say, you know, what's going on here?
There was a murder.
You know, there's three bodies over there under a blanket, and you show up with a microphone and say, what's going on? They say, no comment. Well, that's just foolish.
Yeah.
It's much wiser to say, well, as you can see, there's appear to be three bodies under those blankets, and we think it might be a homicide. So I taught communication skills, but I suppose I take some responsibility. But, it's so much more interesting when everybody just tells the truth. those are the good old days when people just told the truth.
Yeah, and so what's missing then from talk shows of today? Because, I mean, there are stations today like NW. They're flourishing. They have programs. But there are other stations in this market as well, news and talk and, you know, the CBC, of course. It's a very different time when you turn on the radio today than as we listen in your film talk. I mean, the personalities are sort of gone, aren't they?
Well, I think what's missing is the, I'm going to turn this on you. You're a good listener. I mean, you listen for a living. And so you participate, you get what you're looking for from the people you listen to. That's an art. And it's an art that's hard to come by. You have to practice this because, you know, being, confronting a senior politician is a daunting damn thing to do. So you've got to be able to listen clearly and to hold your ground and speak truth to power. And that's a tough set of job skills. And that comes with time. Like you, as much as I love the students I taught, they don't come out of J school doing that day one. They come out of J school holding a microphone, hoping it's plugged in. So to develop the ability to speak clear truth to power, that's a tough thing to do. Well, people who are capable of that cost too much. So in this market, there's no percentage in hiring, you know, somebody who's been at it for 25 years or 30 years who's exquisite and brutal and surgical in listening and asking, because they cost what, five rookies will cost you. So get three rookies, you'll have as much volume of content, save a ton of money. And what's lost is journalism. That's what's happened.
Yeah, and people like Webster and Burns, even though they yelled and screamed, did listen, and listened very carefully, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. They were constantly looking for, so I don't want to use it in the wrong way, but they're looking for, what's the news here? What's important to know? So when I'm interviewing you and you sort of go off on a tangent, I will pull you back to what's key here. And sometimes they would ask the same question 3 and 4 times. And I've done that in interview situations in the last number of years, and people take great offense to being re-asked.
Yeah.
You ask them X, and they go off in the clouds, and you put X back to them. They may go off in the clouds again, and the third time they get really huffy that you dare to insult their intelligence by asking them the same question. And generally speaking, that's intimidating, and young journalists don't want to be – they don't want to look stupid.
Yeah.
So they accept off in the clouds as an answer.
Yeah, and that's the same thing with the interview guest or the whoever you're interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the discourse, I think, has while it seems like it's elevated, has really not, because the right question isn't being asked and the right answer isn't being elicited.
Yeah.
And you have just pablum in the news today.
Filler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any way to go back? I mean, is there any way to make radio relevant again?
I really don't know. You know, that's a sad question, because I don't see how democracy gets any better served as the technology gets better and better. I see the people most able to manage the tools of democracy doing really well, like the Trumps and, you know, our major political parties, because they understand how to move the levers of power. But the reality is that the citizen has very little. In this time, in this town, and for talks, people had real input. People had power. And where they didn't have power, they felt like they did. Like, you could phone up with the premier on the radio, and the talk show host would push a button, and you'd be able to say, "Mr. Premier, I'm mad as hell about that creek flowing down here, and it's going to flood, and what the hell are you going to do about it?"
Mm-hmm.
Long pause. Premier has to say something. Well, that opportunity's gone, and I don't see how that comes back. I'd love it to come back. I think that what might change in politics is the re-advent of politicians who are willing to submit to that. And I think that reinvigoration could actually bring back some political discourse. But it'll have to come from that end of the business, not from the journalism end of the business.
Yeah. I mean, Trump would be happy to go on a talk show because it gives him the chance to be unfiltered, if you will.
Yeah.
And speak for as long as he likes, you know. And I think that may be the way back, I suppose, right? As you say,
yeah,
right?
I think so. But it would be lovely if he were on a talk show with, say, Dan Rather,
rather than say someone from his ilk or the alt right,
yeah,
whatever, which he would probably be on, right? That
yeah.
He's most comfortable with, or
and that's the charm of the downside of politics these days is that the people who are in a political constituency speak to their constituents,
rather than say a Webster who was, or a Burns who was, you know. Yeah. Everybody listened to.
I mean, Christy Clark got elected with a quarter of the possible vote. Her constituency is 25% of British Columbia. Why should she speak to anybody else? She's not going to recruit them.
Yeah.
She just has to keep what she's got. So politics is sort of solidified into these silos. And the politicians that's why we were chatting before we went on about proportional representation. If we go from confrontation politics, which it is now with first past the post, to consensus politics, then the conversation will have to be a little more inclusive and a little more honest and a little more responsive. And I think in that we get a better democracy. But it's not going to come from the journalism end. It'll come from the political end, if.
Just back to whether radio can be relevant again, because I think it is relevant in a lot of circles, especially like the CBC. They're doing tremendous work.
That's true.
And people are listening to their shows on their phones and on their computers and the sort. But just in terms of the numbers, because when you talk in the film, talk about how much these personalities are making and the size of their audience, I mean, those numbers are not there anymore. A talk show host at one of the stations does not make what Rafe Mayer made at his height.
No,
and
Lord, no.
And news anchors today on television don't make, say, what Tony Parsons was making at his height. You could say that those large salaries were commanded because there were huge numbers watching at the time. And we don't have those numbers listening to NW today.
Nope.
That, say, Rafe or Bannerman or Webster had in their heyday.
When I talked to Jim Pattison about this, in 1972, he hired Jack Webster for $100,000 in 1972 to talk on the radio for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. An astounding amount of money. CKNW refused to pay. Jack showed up on Jimmy's radio station. I said, why did you do it? And he said, he made money from day one. Didn't cost. He said, his phrase is, it didn't cost me a dime. Yeah. He came, the listeners came, the ads sold. So it was a very different time.
So don't you think that at the same time, though, if we want it to come back, as I'd like it to come back, there isn't the audience for it anymore?
You know, I think if you could find a forum where everybody would willingly participate, there'd be a huge audience for it. But the challenge is that a politician's going to come in, stay in the message box, say yada, 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 X, Y, Z, and not venture out of that, because the risk involved in venturing out of that is, you know, you have your constituency, and if you offend anybody in there, you're not going to recruit people. You're going to lose people. That's the possibility for talking as a politician. Is you don't want to lose your base. So once we start getting politicians that have enough courage, Larry Campbell, who was mayor of Vancouver, comes to mind. He didn't give a damn. He wasn't running for office all the time. He was the mayor, and he was damned happy to be doing X. And if he didn't like it, well, he had words for you. And very effective and respected by everybody, even the people that didn't like him, because he was blunt and blunt honest. And I think that's where politics needs to go in order to reinvigorate. And I think it will. I really think it will. Yeah. I have no idea how.
Yeah. In the film, you have some great film. Our friend George Garrett, you have his last day, and it's a thrilling moment in the film where he has his scoop on his last day, and it's a big news story politically. And you have the time flashing on the screen as to this is happening in real time as he's confirming the story, and he gets it on the air before everybody else.
Something I'd always wanted. When I started working in radio, you have 58 minutes, no matter what, you know, because it was news every hour. So functionally, you've got 58 minutes to figure it out, get it together, put it on air. And sometimes it comes to you at 5 after the hour, so you can think. And sometimes it comes at 5:30, so you can kind of think. And sometimes it comes at 4 minutes to the hour. There's no time to think. Yeah. And the adrenaline, I always found it to be grand.
Yeah.
Like if you can manage the adrenaline, then you can start to breathe. You can start to put words together. You can start to organize this around what the news criteria. You can figure out how to express it in one take over the radio, bang, and it's done. And I'd always wanted to find a way to capture that sense of what the moment is and show it to people. And what happens with Garrett's last news, his last news scoop is that. And that's as close to the experience of being inside a journalist as you're trying to nail it down.
So it's 10 minutes to the hour, and he has a big political news story. Gordon Wilson at the time, who was an opposition member, is appointed to the NDP cabinet, and you follow through as he makes phone calls to try to get this all confirmed, and then by 11 a.m., he's on the air breaking the story. But when you watch him, and this speaks more to him and his qualities as a journalist, as a person, he seems pretty cool. He seems pretty calm. I mean, and that's the George that you've known for all these years, right?
On the outside, he's very unflappable. But, I mean, as you watch him do what he does in this last little element of the movie, there's a rising panic inside him that doesn't show.
Yeah.
Like, what if I kind of get it? He's trying to confirm what he's been told by somebody who will not go on the record. So he needs to have a conversation with somebody. Because it could be somebody phoning up making mischief.
Yeah.
That's always the fear. So the unnamed source just can't be trusted. So he's trying to confirm to his satisfaction that this is actually the truth. Well, that's not necessarily an objective measure of evidence. That's a preponderance of conversations he squeezes from a variety of people through a series of strategies that you watch as it unfolds. But nobody actually says, yes, it's true.
Mm.
But he comes to be assured that it is true through how he conducts interviews in real time, really quickly, with people who do know.
Yeah.
To the point that he's satisfied to put his entire reputation on the line by going on the radio at 11 o'clock saying, CKNW News has learned.
Yeah.
And it was right.
Yeah, and he's so gifted at just the way he works the phone. I mean, people need to watch this film just for that even. aspiring journalists about how effective he is in getting that story confirmed by people who know,
and
who, as you say, can't say yes or no. You were there in the room with him when this was all happening.
Yeah. Oh yeah, my cameraman and Dennis and I were there, and Dennis was attentive at what was going on, and all of a sudden George got really, like, he's wearing a wireless microphone, so all of his audio is well captured, and all of a sudden he got really serious, and he's on the phone, and he's doing this stuff. I didn't even notice, but Dennis is kneeling next to him, shooting him full frame, and as I'm becoming aware, this looks interesting, this looks exciting. Yeah. I never talked to him during the whole time. I thought it just...
Yeah.
George, the sound of George working the phone, the sound of George having a conversation with the news director, and then the sound of George in the booth saying, CKNW has learned.
Yeah, and Warren Barker's there
reading
the paper, and he consults Warren to get details that he needs confirmed. And then there's a moment where he goes to one of the news deskers, and he tells his story to them, and you see the guy's eyes bug out.
Yeah, because what he's reporting, good journalism is always the thing you least expect until you hear it, and then it makes the most sense.
Yeah.
And for a politician who'd started a political party in opposition to the NDP to then become a member of the NDP and a cabinet member is highly unusual.
Yeah.
Functionally, it's unheard of in BC, but, you know, BC is the Wild West in many ways. And what happened in this town on that morning at 11:05 is every other newsroom in town who listens to NW, they start to pull their hair out.
Yeah.
How the hell did he know? And what are my reporters missing that Garrett knows?
Yeah.
And so cell phones start to go off. People are getting shouted at. Figure this out. And, you know,
Gordon MacDonald says in your film, it's the oh shit moment that everyone in all the other competitors say, oh shit.
Yeah.
Why don't we have that? NW has that. You know?
That is, I mean, in a small, venal kind of self-serving way, that's the buzz of journalism. You got a story, you worked hard on it. I had my share of, not huge stories, but good stories, where I know I say this on the radio now, and I know all of my competitors are going to set their hair on fire for the next hour to try and match it.
Yeah. You also interview in the film someone who is such a part of this town that we... all the years that we were listening, and really didn't get to know, and you have him on film, Frosty Forrest, Brian Forrest.
Oh.
A lot can be said of him and his work, but, I mean, genius is probably one of the top things, right?
He was alleged to be the hardest working man in radio, and because he made it sound so easy, but he would go in, he'd be on the air at 5 in the morning, and it was completely scripted.
Yeah.
Not verbatim, but he knew what, you know, little tidbits he'd been scrounging tidbits and little elements that he would put together for his show. His show was essentially a book that he would read from every morning and make it sound like it was just off the top of his head. And then he had a cast of characters who were willing or not participants in being sort of set up a bit by him and beat up a little bit or played with. And he had great timing, but he worked really, really hard to make it sound piece of cake.
Yeah,
I once or twice on air cross swords with Frosty, and you just know you're going to lose.
Yeah,
because he's got the last word.
It's so sharp,
yeah.
And he's got his finger on the button that it cuts to commercial before you can even breathe. Right.
Yeah. So he told in the film I did with him, he told some great stories about his time. But in the film where I used him in the film, this is about he believed in his heart that his job depended on the news business. Because it was the news of the day that they talked about. And like you said, everybody tuned in at 8 o'clock to hear the news. Because at 8 o'clock in the morning, NW would have hundreds of thousands of people listening in their cars going to work.
Yeah.
And his job was just to make sure people stuck around until the news time.
Yeah. It's people like that that we really miss on the air nowadays, isn't it?
It is. But this is not a simple time anymore. This is a fascinating time. Back then really was a simple time.
Yeah.
And as much as it's interesting to yearn about, the simple time and back then, it's done. And this was my effort to create a documentary that 50 years from now somebody will pull off a shelf and go, that was Vancouver then.
Yeah. There's a marvelous clip of George Garrett driving across the Cambie Bridge, and he's holding the steering wheel, and I guess he's talking to you.
He's actually just thinking out loud at that point.
Yeah, and he says, I love this place.
Yeah.
And you know, you can see as he's retiring from his job as the intrepid reporter in this town, how much he's a part of it. But at the same time, how much, he likes this place.
George knew not every police officer in the Lower Mainland, but of the preponderance of them.
Yeah.
In the 50s and 60s. And so he knew their kids who went into policing in the 70s, and he knew the names of their grandkids. So he would show up at a police scene of a shooting or something, a hostage taking, and they would chat with him because he knew their kids, and he was somebody they could absolutely trust. And so they could trust that he would not betray or compromise an investigation or betray a confidence, that he would report honestly and fairly. And so the community at large had huge access to what was going on inside the community through the trust of somebody like that. And that builds up over decades, and nobody's building that up anymore. So now it's the police tell you what they want you to know. Yeah. That's it.
But beyond that, he's just a lovely guy, as we both know. I mean, I can't tell you how much I enjoy the lunches that the three of us have.
Yeah.
I mean, just what a decent fellow he is.
That's a great word. Yeah, I think he's he still is that person.
Yeah.
And he's the opposite of what you assume a journalist is.
Oh, yeah, you don't think of him as a journalist. But at the same time, if you're talking to him about a story that he did, or even just a new contemporary news story, and you want his take on it, as I have when we go out to lunch, you can see sort of the how his mind works, and if he was a journalist today, how we'd cover that story, and it'd be very different than the sort of news that we see today.
Well, he's a walking context encyclopedia.
Yeah,
I mean that was what was valuable about journalism in that time was Barker knew. Barker had walls of file cabinets of paper, of stories. Mm-hmm. He kept paper on everything, and he had a cross-reference 6 ways from Sunday, so Warren could find out anything about anything, and had context jammed in his head. Reporters then were valued for their context. John Daly, who's an associate, and John and I worked together at NW. John went on to work at Global for a generation, and won a Broadcaster of the Year award just recently because John had context. So John could show up at a police shooting, and because he'd developed the same contextual skills as Garrett did, he knew not just the officer's name, but he knew who they were and what their kids were like and something about them. And so they would trust him, and so they would share something about what was going on that they wouldn't feel comfortable sharing with others. Reporters who bring that context and trust are... Well, there aren't any here right now that I can think of. And there are a couple. Eric Rankin, CBC,
sure,
has a couple.
Yeah.
Eric's my hero these days. So there are Natalie Clancy, CBC.
Wonderful reporter,
Has instituted a huge change in the RCMP. But there are very few.
Yeah.
I take it back. There are very few. Yeah. Not enough.
I mean, I notice that when I watch the news or listen to the news, I'm just getting information rather than the context that I think we need. And it's sort of institutional memory, not just of whatever organization they're covering, but of this province. You know, it's one thing to say that we're in the midst of, I mean, possibly could have a minority government, but what does that mean in terms of British Columbia politics?
Yeah.
And I think that's, you're seeing a little bit of that, but not the kind that you would expect, having seen this film of yours, that I guess we took for granted, and that's why it's gone.
And it just kind of went away when nobody was looking. We're all distracted because... we have YouTube.
Yeah. What else have you got planned for the third? I mean, we're going to see this film.
I'm going to. I have a birthday the day prior, so I've got my larger family showing up, and I'm going to drag them off, and we're going to watch this, and then. I have no idea what's going to happen to it. I've heard that I could find a distributor and put it in theaters, I cannot find a broadcaster. The Knowledge Network looked at it and said, "We don't do this kind of work," which I found. If I was honest what I thought with the Knowledge Network.
I'll tell you how I feel. I mean, the Knowledge Network, which we all pay for, I mean, I'm appalled by that, you telling me that.
Well, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I'll find a broadcast home for it, but...
So people really do have to come out on Saturday the 3rd to see this at the Cinematheque, right?
Absolutely. There will be popcorn.
Yeah, you'll be there. George Garrett will be there. Yeah. And you guys will talk to the audience, I'm sure, after the film, and
one more story?
Yeah, please.
There's a lovely woman named Maureen Chant. Maureen Chant is Jim Pattison's executive assistant, and right. she's been his brains in logistics for 54 years.
You have to go through her to get to him, right?
Everybody who wants to talk to Jimmy about anything except Mrs. Jimmy goes through Maureen. Maureen is a gatekeeper, and she's very, I mean, the two of them, you know, made $9, $10 billion.
Yeah.
Mostly his, but, you know,
yeah.
she has a good ownership of the whole enterprise. So you go through Maureen, and you know, as a journalist, you knew as a journalist in this town, you want Jim Pattison, you phone her. If she sees the value, he's on the phone. If she doesn't, you're dead. So I ran into Pattison at a retirement party a couple of years ago, told him about the movie, said, did he want to play? He said, phone Maureen. I phoned Maureen. She listened for 5 minutes. Next day, I've got an interview. He's delightful. candid, nostalgic, yeah. wistful, full of beans, really a sharp guy.
Yeah.
And he lives in this spaceship at the top of some huge building downtown. And it was a really delightful afternoon. I get the thing finished, and I send out invitations. I send an invitation to Maureen and to Jimmy. She sends me a note back. I'll have to rearrange his schedule. He's out of town that day. And I thought, oh, he's going to come. She said, hey, might well. She said, can you send me a link? So I sent her a link. The film's 85 minutes long. 86 minutes later, I hear back from her. She's in tears. This was her time. These were her people. She's negotiating with Pat Burns and Jack Webster. This is absolutely her. This is her, an aspect of her life captured, and it just touched her in such a huge way. And unfortunately, Jimmy's not going to be in town and can't come, but could he see it too?
So yeah.
I said, you tell him when he wants to see it, I'll bring popcorn to his office. But it was lovely, this woman who's sort of the Iron Maiden gatekeeper for BC's most interesting wealthy man melted
yeah.
when she watched this. So I thought, yeah. come and watch. You'll love it.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned $10 billion of wealth that he's created in various sectors in this yeah. province. But he really enjoyed his time owning a radio station, didn't he?
He told me. I mean, he had the apocryphal car dealership and the local yeah. salesman got fired and all that stuff. He told me that he made all of the money he made out of CJOR was what he used to bankroll his empire. It had such a huge cash flow because he's yeah. Mr. Leverage, you know, Mr. Yeah. You know, take 10 cents, make it 10 bucks. He bankrolled his entire empire out of the proceeds of that radio station, out of talk. So Jim Pattison made his fortune out of talk radio.
And he liked hanging out, not hanging out, but he liked dealing with people like Webster and Burns, right? I mean, that was more exciting than, say, the salesman at the car lot, probably.
Yeah, I mean, he had a stable of characters that were the talk of the town.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, he owned the talk of the town on the one side, and Bill Hughes, who was the general manager at CKNW, was really his competition. So I've got a considerable amount of Bill, too,
and mm-hmm.
because this was, competition makes journalism better.
Yeah.
Competition makes a lot of things better, but in this town at this time, competition between these two major radio stations, CKNW and CJOR, each drove the other to be higher, harder, better, sharper.
Yeah. Well, you've done a great service with this film, and I know Thanks. That it's going to be a great afternoon on the 3rd. I'll be there, and I hope a lot of other people will be there as well. And I do hope, as you've said already, that years from now people will pick this up, however way they'll pick it up.
Exactly.
And see what's missing, and see what this town was. I mean, it's a great document, and you're to be commended for it. I appreciate you coming in to talk about this, and good luck with it.
It's always a pleasure to chat. Thanks, Joe.
Saturday, the 3rd of June, noon at the Pacific Cinematheque. That's when doors open. 12:30 is when the thing starts. And there will be popcorn, as George says. George Orr, join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.